In the US, a growing national student movement is trying to find the balance between the rights of an increasingly diverse student body and what many see as persistent and structural racism on campus. Students from 80 US colleges, many of them elite institutions, have created a list of demands. These include urging universities to hire more faculty from black and minority groups, more aid for students of colour, and more training for staff on how to deal with issues of race. But the demands also call for restrictions on racially insensitive remarks, the removal of terms like master when referring to heads of college, and as we've seen, the removal of the names or statues of historical figures who profited from slavery. Now, is that taking things too far? And more importantly, might it distract from what is a serious attempt to address long-standing inequality? Our guest is David Cole. David is Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown, and we were absolutely enthralled by his nuanced piece for the New York Review of Books. He wrote that the student protests offer some valuable lessons on the powers of free speech and the dangers of seeking restrictions on it. David joins us now from the US. Welcome back to the Little Wireless Program, David.
Thanks so much for having me.
David, let's start with some context. Students are saying there is a systematic and structural racism on campuses across your country, beginning with an overwhelmingly white faculty. Are they correct?
Well, I think they certainly have a basis for concern and for protest, and I think in many ways, the protests that we have seen are a reflection of the First Amendment in action, of students of color who have come on to relatively recently integrated facilities with long histories, being governed by and almost exclusively for white men. And raising concerns about whether these institutions, now that they've opened their doors to students of color in a more significant way, whether they need to also change some of their practices in order to respond to and deal with the new reality of a truly diverse student body.
But the opposite side of the coin is, as you point out, the paradox that college campuses are among the most integrated places in the U.S.
Yeah, if they were not integrated, you wouldn't hear these protests because there wouldn't be anyone to protest. And even if they were integrated only, as they were for a long time, only in sort of token numbers, there would not be a sufficient sort of critical mass to launch a protest. But now that we're achieving something like a critical mass, some more significant representation of minority students, particularly in a number of the elite institutions in the United States, higher education institutions, you're seeing those students who are sort of new arrivals on the scene saying, wait a minute, it's not enough just to let us in. You also need to deal with some of the assumptions that underlie that have underlined this system for so long. And I think they're also, it's not just the students at Yale or at Brown or at Harvard. They're not just protesting about how Yale, Harvard, and Brown treat them or how they structure their courses or what their faculty looks like, but they're also, I think, reflecting the broader concern in the American body politic about race in America. And you see that concern in the movement of Black Lives Matter. And so you've got, you have these viral videos of young black men being shot by police, all appearing almost on a weekly basis. And then you have these students who have been sort of fortunate enough, have sort of risen above the norm and have managed to get into these very, very exclusive institutions. And I think at once they feel an affinity for those who continue to suffer at the hands of police, et cetera, because you know, at the end of the day, they're young black men too, walking around. They too can get stopped by the police in the very towns that they're going to school in, and they feel some disconnect, both, you know, in terms of their, they are obviously privileged, and they're in a privileged institution that does not fully include them. And so they've done what students, you know, historically have done when they are unhappy with a particular set of circumstances, which is to get together, to organize, to demonstrate, to make demands, to call into question the status quo. And, you know, I think that's, as I said, I think that's a reflection that the First Amendment is working on college campuses, that the students are, and it's a reflection of the success of integration, that there are sufficient numbers to raise these concerns in a serious way.
David, you're talking to a country which absorbs American cultures as though we were made of blotting paper, but we have until comparatively recently been a Halloween-free zone. And I mention Halloween because, of course, one of the most galvanizing moments came when students at Yale wanted guidelines about Halloween costumes introduced. Tell us the story.
So it wasn't, I don't think it was the students who asked for guidelines with respect to the Halloween costumes, but you're right that it was a, this all broke loose at Yale anyway, last fall, when the diversity committee of the Yale administration sent out a memo to all students saying, you know, we understand that Halloween is coming up. We understand that people like to get dressed up at Halloween time, but please be sensitive to the sensitivities of your fellow students when you think about what kind of costume to wear. And I think that memo was itself prompted by an incident a couple of years ago where some students went out in Halloween in blackface. White students went out in blackface, and that was deemed offensive. So the school was basically saying, you know, you're free to do what you want, but please be sensitive. In response to that, a number of students felt like this was a little heavy-handed. Halloween is just a fun time. People are wearing costumes. You know, for the school to tell people what costumes they can or cannot wear, even if they're doing it with a light touch, is infantilizing, etc. And they raised those concerns to the wife of a master of a residential college.
This is Erica Christakis.
Erica Christakis, who is her husband is the master or the head of Silliman College, one of the residential colleges at Yale, and she's the associate master. She also taught there in the Yale Child Study Center, and she sent out a note to her students, that is the students in their residential college, raising concerns about whether this kind of memo goes too far, and whether we ought not be concerned about the flip side of this, which is the chilling of speech. And sometimes, in order to have a campus that is open to free expression, you need to have the freedom of students to say things that will offend others. And
well, you sum this up very nicely when you say that unis should feel physically safe, but intellectually they must be challenging.
Absolutely. So, and that was basically her point: was we don't want to be coddling our students. We want students to feel free to speak out as they were, and they should feel free to be offensive. Well, the minority students took that as an invitation to students to go out in blackface or in other offensive kinds of costumes, and so they and that prompted a week of a very, very intense protests, sit-ins, discussions at the college, including a set of demands delivered to the president of Yale at midnight at his home, and in those demands were As you said at the outset of the show, some things that made a lot of sense, like how about having a diverse faculty as well as a diverse student body? The faculty is overwhelmingly white and very few faculty of color from disadvantaged minorities. And how about funding the cultural centers, the student cultural centers, the African American cultural center at a pace that reflects the increased number who are here? And how about providing aid to minority students so that they can afford to be here? And how about firing Erica Christakis? And that was the, you know, and a number of other things, changing the name of a college, et cetera. And you know, that's where, in my view, the students really went too far.
And you also make the point that it's often easier said than done to, you know, to change race balance within faculty. You point out that hiring African American and Latino faculty isn't that easy because there's a dearth of them with doctorates. And if you hire from other unis, you just shift the problem.
No, that's absolutely true. And Yale has, in response to this, and I think even before this, was had in the pipeline a plan to put significant resources into attracting more minority students into the profession of teaching, so that there are more potential candidates when positions open up, and that's certainly a problem. That, you know, the best minority students in, you know, in the top universities really have a lot of options open to them, and not that many of them pursue academia. Many more pursue business or the professions than pursue academia, and so there just isn't the pool that you would need. But, you know, you can do things to increase the size of the pool. You can really try to reach out and mentor, create mentoring programs, create scholarships. There's all sorts of things one can do. Yale is doing that, and I think that that kind of pressure makes some sense. Yale, I think, has been around for 200 and some years, and for many years it had 0% of black faculty. It now has something like 3% black faculty. So, you know, it hasn't improved a whole lot over 200 and some years on these numbers, and I think that's something that the students should be pressing on. But when the students push over to expression and start to say, well, we should be punishing people for saying things that we find offensive, like Erica Christakis, then I think they are acting in ways that I think are actually self-defeating, in addition to run counter to the principles of free expression and free academic inquiry.
My guest is David Cole, and David is Professor of Law at Georgetown. Did Christakis survive?
Well, survive. It depends on what you mean by survive. She's living. She is no longer teaching at the Yale Child Study Center, and she is no longer the associate master of Silliman College. But and I think, you know, some of her defenders would say she was driven out by this by the kind of community pressure inflicted on her and her husband by the students, really. But I will say, to the university's credit, that the university did not ask her to leave. The university did not fire her, as the students requested. The university did not ask her husband, who was the master or the head of the college, to resign. They stood by their principle that they protect free expression, and they're not going to respond to demands to punish someone because they said something that other students find offensive. But so the university did the right thing. The Christakises have now stepped down from their position as the head and associate head of the college of this residential college at Yale. Nicholas Christakis is still a professor at Yale, and they still live in New Haven, and to my knowledge, and they're still part of that institution. But they clearly suffered.
Of course, it's not just race that makes issues like this flare up. An old friend of mine and of the programs is Peter Singer, and you will recall, as I do, that Peter was, there was a very energetic attempt to drive Peter from his chair because of things he'd said about disabled people, which they found deeply offensive.
Yeah. No, it's not This is an instinct that is part of mankind, right? We don't like to be confronted with ideas that we deem offensive, and so where we have the power to suppress them, we often yield to the temptation to invoke that power, and you saw that in the. In the Cold War era here in the United States, anyone who was at all socialist or to the left of that was branded a communist, and people lost their jobs. They were fired, they were investigated, they were called before Congress, some were prosecuted, some spent time in jail, not for anything that they had done, but for simply what they had said. The majority didn't like what they had said. And what I find most sort of ironic about and troubling about the calls for regulation of speech and control of speech on campuses coming from minority students today is that it's as I said, sort of self-defeating, because the right to protest, the right to say things that the majority doesn't like, that's something that minorities have used to push for equality and will continue to use to push for equality. The power to suppress speech is the power of the majority, the power of the establishment to suppress those who are in the minority, those who say things that are, deemed offensive by the majority. If they're not deemed offensive by the majority, there won't be any suppression. So the suppression only comes when you have majority support. So if you're sort of speaking from a perspective of we are outsiders, we are a minority, we are making demands for our equal treatment and equal dignity, you ought to recognize that free speech is your friend, not your enemy, and you should deploy it and defend it, not seek to suppress it.
Hence your writing, the protests, the list of demands, the rallies, the political organizations are in the best tradition of free speech, and you fully support that, but you also believe passionately in what C. Van Woodward said, that within the academy there must be the right to think the unthinkable, discuss the unmentionable, and challenge the unchallengeable.
Absolutely, that's the critical point, and that C. Van Woodward report was from came out of the late 60s and early 70s, when during the Vietnam War era. Students were shouting down and stopping from speaking various speakers who weren't sufficiently against the war, and I think Yale responded appropriately, or this committee responded appropriately, by reminding the community that this is the only way you have a free academic inquiry. Look, if I'm teaching criminal justice in my law school class, and we're talking about racial profiling, for example, a major issue in America today, people have to feel free to say what they think, and if they are afraid that if they say something that any group of students is going to find offensive, they're just not going to speak up. And then you don't have a conversation. You don't have an exchange of ideas. So I think it's absolutely critical that people are free to say what they want to say. And that's the way that we reach across the divides that, the race and gender and class divides that that afflict us.
Let's talk about Georgetown University specifically. It was found to directly benefit from the sale of slaves in bygone days, and of course that would be the case for many other universities as well. Georgetown chose to acknowledge this past. How was that received?
I think it's been received quite positively. I think it's in a sense it's a kind of a reckoning with the institution's own past, and in a sense a form of reparations provided to the survivors, to the descendants of the slaves who have been told they will be they are welcome to apply to Georgetown, and their applications will be given special solicitude akin to the solicitude that Georgetown provides to the children of alumni and other people who get benefits in at the admission stage because for a variety of reasons. So I think. It was Georgetown really sort of in some sense got the institution, the administration got ahead of the curve and really said we're gonna before this thing blows up, we are going to really take a hard look at our past, disclose what we learn about our past, and then take actions based upon the findings that we make, and I think that's an act of civic responsibility.
David, there's a poignancy in the fact that we're having this discussion at a time when race is seething and boiling in your presidential contest.
Absolutely, and I think this issue is obviously number one. Not resolved, right? Some people have taken the position, well, and the Supreme Court, for example, about 12, 13 years ago said, we shouldn't need affirmative action for more than 25 more years. In other words, we've pretty much are at the end of resolving the problem of race in America.
That was also loudly said when Obama got elected. It was the end.
Exactly.
The end
exactly.
of race hatred.
Yeah, and I think all you need to do is, as somebody said, all you need to do is look at the comments on virtually any internet, op-ed or blog about a subject of race, and you will see that racism is not dead in America. And all you need to do is look at the kinds of things that Donald Trump supporters say, and that Donald Trump himself says. And all you need to do is look at some of the videos that we have seen of the way that young African American men are so quickly assumed to be dangerous criminals when they are simply, mententally disturbed or what have you, and shot and killed as a result. We have a deep problem of racism in this country, and I think part of what's going on with these protests is a sense that it's been 60 some years since the Supreme Court declared that segregation was unconstitutional, and the promise of equality that the civil rights era put forth in both Supreme Court decisions and federal laws and the like, just has not been delivered upon. So yes, the African Americans and Hispanics are better situated, significantly better situated today than they were half a century ago. That's without question. But African Americans in particular are still at the bottom rung of the ladders of our society, and they are still disproportionately concentrated in what are essentially segregated inner city communities. And those communities have so little in terms of opportunities and in terms of chances for people to grow up there and really have an equal shot. And the only
David, I'm afraid we've got a part company, but I thank you very much for your contribution and your passion. David Cole, Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown Law, and I would like now to thank the team, Lila Schooner, producers Amrutha Slee, Sasha Fegan, Anna Whitfield, Stan Corrie, and Gail Bossario. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week.